You mentioned that, Cullen, that you should have learned one of these songs. It's funny to me. I guess I didn't assume Elvis movies would have music in them, but I think it's a fair assumption. Like, it was, I don't know, like, now, if you have a singer in a movie, it's not a requirement that they sing. But when Elvis was in, you know, the movies, most of the movies that we're talking about this month, it's like, no, he's got to sing like 8 times.
Because they were, they're musicals, and they had to have the soundtrack album.
Is it
these
a
were
musical?
Products.
This is, yeah, I don't know.
This is a musical.
They were selling albums. This guy recorded 8 million songs and put out 10 million albums. And this, you know, the soundtrack and the kids are going to come to hear. I mean, that's a major part of it. Yes.
8 million albums, however many platinums, only one Elvis Aaron Presley.
I'm going to learn One Track Heart and do a cover of it because that song just rips. Like, that could have been, I don't know why the Ramones didn't cover that.
That's genius. That would have been great.
Like, I don't know, it's like the chord progression, like when it gets to like the little, like, you know, the turnaround when they you know, sing the One Track Mind with the One Track Heart. Like, that's such a Joey Ramone.
One Track Heart. One Track Heart. One Track Heart.
1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, man. I like the soundtrack.
Hey, ho, roust about.
That would have been a good alternate theme.
You guys want to talk about some Elvis on the culture?
Hell yeah.
You ready?
Yeah.
Richard Haddam?
So ready.
You ready, Colin Gallagher of Pulp Serenade?
Oh, yeah, I'm ready.
Are you ready, Elvis?
Oh, boy.
Yeah. That was a terrible impression. I don't have an Elvis impression. I tried to pull that out of my ass, and it's the first and last time I'm going to do an Elvis impression.
Give us your Richard Elvis. Hey, Elvis, give us your Richard Haddam impersonation.
Hey, everybody. How's that?
That's a lot better than mine. I think that's pretty, pretty good.
I can just do that, like, like that fucking, like, the whatever, like, weird noise that he makes. That, like, but I.
That's a great noise.
I think I was sort of doing Nicolas Cage doing Elvis.
Which he's never played Elvis, so. Interesting.
Yet.
Right? A lot of people have played Elvis. But you know who doesn't have to play Elvis in this movie? Elvis. Because on this episode of the Culture Cast, we're talking about an Elvis movie. The first movie of You've Never Seen September, which Father Malone programmed. But he's not here. So it kind of feels like Father Malone just wanted to make me watch a bunch of Elvis movies.
I'm just a roustabout, shifting from town to town. No job can hold me down. I'm just a knock-around guy. There's a lot of space beneath that sky. Until I find my place, there's no doubt I'll be a roving roustabout. Nobody never gave nothing to me but hard knocks. All I ever knew was hard knocks. And I'm telling you, I said, you better beware, because I've had my share.
You girls are new here, aren't you?
Hey, all right, knock it off, buddy.
Let's get up there.
Get off, buddy.
Come on.
No, that's karate.
Come on.
Elvis, getting the chicks all worked up, but cutting loose from any dolly who can tie him down. Until he meets the one girl who can tie him up.
You better leave, Charlie, please.
Well, because it was good?
Because it isn't right for me. I'm not a one-night stand.
Hiya, 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 the big show is about to begin. He's back, he's ready, and here he is now.
It's Elvis Presley, freewheeling, free-swinging on the Carnival Midway, where there's girls galore, the main attraction for any two-fisted roustabout.
Hey!
What are you doing?
What's the matter?
Come on, look back.
Oh, you want this?
No. Don't be funny.
Elvis, shilling and shouting as he starts roustaboutin', strumming and humming till the crowd start coming to the girl shows and the side shows, where there's fun and excitement in the air, and danger and daring on the ground.
You want to try it? Like I told you, I'm a coward.
Well, right behind me then. Dames do that.
Oh, thanks.
Goodbye, dear.
Give me the helmet.
Oh,
just did.
Yeah, now forget it, mister. Here, take another ball.
That's Kathy up there,
listen,
Joe.
Kid, I told you.
You keep out of this. Look, I'm a real peaceable man, son, but I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to pick up one more ball. If you're still standing there after I throw it, I'm going to break your spine.
Big love, big heartache. Oh, yes, I know it's true. The more you fall in love.
She had a ruby on her tummy and a diamond big as Texas on her toe. She let her hair down and she did the hoochie-coochie real slow.
It's everyone's oyster. Step up, get your pearl. It's so wonderful, 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 wonderful.
What Elvis movies are in the September roster of Elvis movies besides the one we're discussing tonight?
King Creole, mm-hmm, and Fun in Acapulco.
Are just these three?
Yeah, well, that was a first week, but we
okay.
So what was the first one?
We didn't watch any. I watched it, but it did never got recorded. It was
which movie was it?
What the fuck was that? It was so memorable. I don't even remember. Girl Happy.
So King Creole is a great choice. Fun in Acapulco is terrific. I'm interested why he didn't pick like Viva Las Vegas.
Given that Father Malone lives in Las Vegas, yeah, I wondered the same thing. But yeah, we're not talking about Blue Hawaii either. So
King Creole was the last movie he made before going into the military.
Is that a question or a statement?
Or both. and I quote.
I didn't look up King Creole because I didn't think we were talking about that. But it's a terrific movie. I love Elvis movies. I went on a bender a few years ago and watched all of them.
Well, some people feel that the ones before he went into the military are of a significantly different quality than the ones that he made after he came back from the military.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would say like Loving You for like the early films, Loving You is amazing. I think Elizabeth Scott's in that. Love Be Tender is terrific. I mean, Jailhouse Rock, King Creole, those are great.
King Creole is the one that he had to get a deferment for 60 days from the military to make.
Yep.
So the overwhelming theory is then anything after King Creole is a lesser product than beforehand because of
it's kind of like when the Marx Brothers went from Paramount to MGM. It's like you'll still watch them, but they're not the classic ones that you would point people to.
I do agree they're very different. I think they're kind of great in a different way. But Viva Las Vegas, I think, is an exception because that's George Sidney directing and written by Sally Benson, who, I mean, goes back to Meet Me in St. Louis. I mean, George Sidney was part of the Arthur Freed unit. So in some ways, I think like Viva Las Vegas is sort of like one of the last great classic MGM musicals. And it has like ton of like production values, ton of, I don't know. I love all the songs. I'm a huge Anne Margaret fan. I think for his late career, Viva Las Vegas is just kind of unbeatable.
Okay. It's a highlight.
Richard.
I haven't
all
seen
right.
it.
We can just...
Hey, listen, I know we're, I mean, I'm hoping this is all part of the podcast. I have never seen an Elvis Presley movie until 3 hours ago.
Really?
Neither had I, which is something that I wanted to ask you about, Richard, and now I know we're both on the same page.
Oh my goodness, I can give you, okay, there's some really great Elvis movies, if you liked this, and I hope you did.
What's the one where he's, is a man named Joe? Come along, Joe?
Stay Away, Joe.
Stay Away, Joe.
I mean, if you're looking for like a great late, I have a particular fondness for the late Elvis movies because I think they get like really decadent and ridiculous. One of my favorites is Live a Little, Love a Little from 1968, which begins with him on a beach. And I think this woman is trying to like you know,
pull
bring
him back
home.
Into the ocean.
No, no, to her apartment. And like he starts like running away and she like sends her dogs after him. And then he goes from there to like a couple job interviews and he winds up getting both jobs and they both require different uniforms and are on different floors of the same building. So he's like running back and forth from both from floor to floor, like changing costume, trying to hold both jobs at the same time.
Wasn't this movie originally written for Jerry Lewis?
I mean, I could see this being a Jerry Lewis type of movie.
I actually have to correct what I said. I have seen an Elvis movie before, Change of Habit. And I mention it because Ed Asner recently passed away. And I actually got to speak to Ed Asner long ago about Change of Habit.
Oh, man.
Super
How
fun.
Was that?
He was super cool. I mean, obviously, like, he was a pretty pretty dialed in dude, too, at least, you know, politically and socially active, which I appreciate, as I know the three of us, you know, do as well. But I don't remember that movie at all, and I would assume, Cullen, it's pretty different from a lot of the other Elvis movies, right?
It's a weird movie because it's like super late for him, and
it's his last movie role.
There are aspects of that, like medically, where you watch that and it's just like, holy shit, this was like medical ethics at the time. And it's like tries to have a little bit more of a social conscience that, and I don't think it didn't really hold up. They're like really it's a really interesting movie, more than a good one. Whereas like Live a Little, Love a Little is just like wonderful and absurd and silly.
And Elvis's character in Change of Habit, Richard, since you already mentioned him, is named John Carpenter. Dr. John Carpenter. Because nice. Elvis is a doctor in the ghetto in that movie.
Well, sure. Of course.
Where else?
Of course.
I was going to ask, do either of you know how to see like Lou Grant's spinoff series? Because I saw a few episodes on YouTube, and that was really great. But I don't think that's
a great show. I mean, I remember watching it, but I don't know where it's streaming or if it's streaming. It might be available on DVD if you're willing to pay money to Amazon.
I mean, there are alternate people to buy DVDs from. I've bought many DVDs this week.
So who do you buy from to avoid Amazon?
I mean, I went to Academy Records on 18th Street and got some stuff this week. Mary Hartman.
Okay, you just went.
Oh shit,
went
Mary
down
Hartman.
To
hey,
18th
Richard, Mary Hartman.
Street. Yeah, Mary Hartman.
What the fuck?
9,042 episodes.
No,
right?
That was on the Barney Miller. That was on the Barney Miller episode you were on. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, but is there like a is there like an online source that has a deep catalog of DVDs that you can patronize instead of Amazon?
Yeah, I mean, like, depending on what you want to get, like Facets out of Chicago is a great independent video store.
Like there's this thing called bookshop.org, which is basically the independent bookstore's answer to Amazon. And you buy books there and they donate a bit of every purchase to a fund that is then distributed to all independent bookstores. And you order your books through independent bookstores, but you can get the new Stephen King, or older books or whatever. So it's like a good alternative to Amazon when you're buying books.
Yeah, that sounds lovely. I wish there's something like that for video stores, but I just know there's a few small stores you can Google and find. But Facets is a great place.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the
roustabout,
the plot of this movie. So Elvis is a
roustabout.
Yeah, right. Elvis is a roustabout. The end. So Elvis is a traveling musician who falls in with some carny folk in the carny land of somewhere in a Californian open field somewhere, because most of the film looked like it was filmed in the valley, Richard. Almost all of it.
Oh, it did.
Yeah. We'll just drive 10 miles down the road and film this movie.
Or because they don't say exactly where they are, but they did say that Phoenix is west of where they are. So I'm like, well, it doesn't really look like New Mexico, but maybe it's Eastern Texas. Maybe it could be. And he says he's come from Shreveport. So I was trying to get it. I feel like it's got to be in Texas somewhere, even though no one really had a Texas accent except for Pat Buttram, who has sort of a generally southerny rural accent. Right, right, right. Yeah. And he's great, by the way.
Before he meets up with the Carney folk, there's the great scene at Mother's Tea House where he gets on stage and starts like heckling some like frat jocks with Poison Ivy League, which is a very fun number. And then they take him out back and try to beat him up, and he karate chops them. And apparently that fight, actually, he did his own stunt and wound up in the hospital.
Because this is not a big stunt sequence. This is him going, hi-ya! He looks like Hong Kong Phooey.
Yeah.
It is. This is
what's
not,
the fear, man?
You know,
like, don't catch my hands, man. Like, what?
So whatever happened, he wound up getting some stitches. And,
oh, for fuck's sake.
And then he goes to jail.
But wait. But first we have to make it clear that he has a Japanese motorcycle that they call a sickle.
Yeah.
These college dudes are calling it. By the way, the college dudes all look like they're about 40.
Wow.
And
hey, I'm almost 40 and I'm back in school. You know, it's
But are you wearing the cardigan with the letter?
Are you wearing your letter jacket? Just like out and about?
No, I just wear band t-shirts.
Okay. So all right. Point made. But now they go back out and they make fun of him for riding a Japanese bike.
Yeah.
And because that's un-American. And then he karate chops them in this fight and says, and they're like, whoa, look out. He's doing that karate stuff. And Elvis says, yeah, it comes with the bike. Okay. Now, Elvis is involved in several fights throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. Never again, as far as I saw, does he use martial arts.
That's probably because. Maybe it's because it backfired and he went to the hospital and Hal Wallace was like, dude, I'm not having you go to the hospital.
Again.
Hey, you can't trust those Eastern methods of fighting. You gotta go back to all American.
They didn't come with the sickle.
Yeah, apparently not.
And so he gets into this fight with these guys, and then he runs into Kathy, played by Joan Freeman. And her father, like we mentioned already, Leif Erikson plays her father, who's fantastic in this. And her father tries to kill him.
Yep. Tries to run him off the road.
Straight up tries to murder Elvis in the first scene that they're in together.
Which is a little weird considering what we find out about him later in the movie.
Well, he's kind of an alcoholic, kind of got some anger management issues.
But Elvis kind of... Wasn't there also a tragedy in his past?
Well, yeah, because while he was drunk, he apparently didn't set up a ride correctly, and it resulted in a bunch of people dying, and then there was a lawsuit, and that's right. Why Barbara Stanwyck, who's his wife, is in hock, and like has right. to owes a lot of money to right. the bank.
Yes. Cut to, he's trying to run Elvis, who's riding a motorcycle. He's trying to run him off the road and then does run him off the road and could have easily killed him.
And then goes, it's your fault. You were on the road making eyes at my daughter. That's a reason enough to literally kill you. A
lot of people in this movie vying for role of king asshole.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, like we had kind of mentioned at the top, I personally had no idea what to expect with these Elvis movies. I kind of expected, like you mentioned, Richard, I kind of expected these to feel like a product, like very well put together with a lot of music, meant to sell albums, and that's it. That was my expectation.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say that this wasn't that, but there were some things I enjoyed, but I think in a lot of ways, this feels very commercial ready.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Personally, I will say that I'm a sucker for a carnival. Anyone who knows me and has followed my episodic television career knows that when I have the opportunity to set something in a carnival, I don't pass it up.
Of course
not. The minute we got to the carnival, my little interest meter went straight up. I'm not talking about my dick, but I think you know what I'm saying.
I loved like some of the carnival touch. I mean, just like the footage of it with all the people and the way it's set up, and the billboards, the painted signs, the guy who's explaining like, well, the reason I got into, you know, eating fire was because I got my start as a sword swallower, and does both of those right in front of you. Like, it's some nice little atmosphere background there.
And they start, here's what else I love. They start by giving you like a little lesson in the jargon of the carnies.
Oh, that scene is amazing.
Isn't it the best? She brings him over. And there's all these signs, and it's like, wait, what's this? What's that? Oh, well, this, and I should have taken notes.
Grab
but it's
joint,
like, oh,
Richard.
That means that's the hamburger stand. That's the bathroom. That means, you know, it's the, you know, what, and it's just like, literally, you could not figure this out. So immediately you're like, oh, we're in a world, different language, different jargon, different kinds of people who operate on, you know, different values. And now he's entering this world. So all that stuff is really great. And you feel like you too are being brought into this world. So it's that's a really charming, involving sequence.
There's a grab joint. That's hot dog stand. And mm-hmm. There's the grease joint. That's the burger stand. And then there's at least one other one.
I mean, there's the mitt camp, and that's for the fortune teller.
Right. And then there's the tea house. I guess, which is, they use tea house to be like, I guess, like a bar. Like, why are they hiding their alcohol at the beginning of the movie? This isn't Prohibition, is it? This is in the 60s.
They probably don't have a license. They're probably, I mean, they're just traveling. They're in a rural area. They're probably not supposed, it's like, yeah, you can sell lemonade and food, but you can't sell all, I mean, all the southern states have a lot of laws about alcohol.
Sure do.
It could be a blue laws or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder if some of those people were like underage.
That also could be.
Well, it's funny because they do that in the very first lines of the movie at Mother's Tea House.
Yeah.
Are, hey guys, you know, stick to the Coca-Cola. Hey, we're over 21. Yeah, you're over 21. You're about three times that age.
what year were you? And then the lady, is your birthday?
Look, by the way, and I bet Cullen agrees with me. If the entire movie had taken place at Mother's Tea House, I would have been fine.
Oh, yeah.
Same.
That's fantastic.
I would have watched that movie over this one any day, because there were some pretty interesting characters running around in that place. That's an interesting
scene. The waitress, yeah, she's like, well, we call it Mother's Tea House so that we would be, you know, more in than in, but we're going to change it to something that's more in or more out. And by the way, if that light over there starts to blink on and off, that means the cops are coming. So ditch the beers and, you know, drink your Cokes.
Goes back to Moe's Pet Shop.
I mean, it almost feels like it's like a different movie that he has left because he's lost his job. And now he's got to go somewhere else. And the rest of Roustabout is just like the in-between.
Yeah, it pretty much is. Yeah, but Mother's Tea House was charming.
Here's the thing that I have a problem with. And I'm hoping I don't run into this in all the Elvis movies, but it's made itself pretty apparent in this movie. He's been performing for a while, yeah? Like, going around and performing. Oh, yeah. He's immensely talented, and it just now is dawning on people that that's the case?
What do you mean?
You know what I'm... If you're going to have a movie with Elvis, don't make him a musician in the movie. Because then, like, he is one of the greatest musicians of all time. And anytime they're like, he's like just a normal guy. My suspension of disbelief, it's strained a little bit.
But that is the key to all of these.
Sure,
movies.
No, I get it. I mean, they have to essentially hang a lantern on it. Scene one, like he plays the guitar. What do you want us to say? Like, you know, he sings.
Certainly every movie where a musician stars as a musician. And there's the portion of the movie where their career hasn't started. They're getting booed off stage. And you're like, what are we looking at? Why are they booing Barbara Streisand? Don't they know she's but it's like, but that's all movie icons. It's like, why are you picking a fight with Clint Eastwood? It's Clint Eastwood. Hey, asshole. It's like, well, this is not, don't you know this is Dirty Harry?
I appreciate that. It's just, again, with someone like Elvis, it's a little harder because of Elvis is, there is only one Elvis. There are few artists like Elvis, right? There are like, four artists like Elvis?
But the charm of Elvis is that he seems like, well, he's just a country boy off the farm.
Right.
What's that thing? What's that? You call that a guitar? Well, let me see that. Yeah. Well, okay.
That's the best part about Elvis's performance is his disarming Southern charm. Yeah. He can be such a prick, but at the same time, you're just like, I love you because you're Elvis.
And I don't know what his persona is typically in movies because this is the first one I've seen. And in this one, he is specifically and overtly playing a bad boy who has not had the love of a family, who doesn't know how to fit in with good people. Okay, because he's a roustabout. But I got to say something. And this was a surprise to me. I don't know if it's because, you know, he was a great actor playing the role of what I just described. But I found him vaguely creepy and not super engaging. And a little bit like, yeah, I don't think I would gravitate toward this person if I met them in real life. This person is a little
emotionally aloof.
A little blank around the eyes, yeah. a little
it was
like
weird. Like he was trying to make it. He was trying to give us as the audience a reason to understand his aversion to other people and why other characters might have an aversion to him. And I didn't buy it.
But I think my thing is I did buy it because I found him to be borderline as unpleasant as he was trying to be. I get that he's Elvis. I get that he's, you know, but I'm like, oh, I kind of thought they would just sort of play it like he's sort of a roustabout and people don't like him, but they don't like him because he's so amazingly charming and such a rogue. And we just love him anyway. And I'm sort of like, no,
he's kind
I'm
of
not
a
sure.
He's a little more hard boiled in this than in some of the other ones. Yeah. I think it was a little deliberate. I think he can be. I think he's a good actor. So I think there's a little bit of he was trying to do that. I think there was a little bit of, you know, I think some of these movies bored him because he had aspirations to do better material. So I think some of those scenes he's just kind of vacant because it's just like he's not in that engaged. But I do think some of the best moments are like when he and Barbara Stanwyck have moments together because she's fabulous because she's always fabulous. But there's like a little extra spark between the two of them. And my guess would be he obviously knows who Barbara Stanwyck is and appreciates her talent. And I think that might inspire just a little bit. It gives him something to work with as an actor.
I would agree. Those scenes were the best scenes. That is curious. So in the decade or more that he was making these movies, there was never an opportunity. No one ever said, hey, this guy might sort of be Brando. Why don't we like actually put him in a movie?
Oh, King Creole.
Oh, was that like a musical dramatic role?
I can't remember the songs, but like those first four that you're talking about are more serious. Like Loving You, is really good. Later on, you know, he does like Flaming Star, which is like a more serious Western directed by Don Siegel. So there are moments where he got to do a little bit of that, but I think he wanted more of that. And from my understanding, the Colonel wanted him to go the opposite. And so for me, an interesting scene is because you're talking about how tough he is, you know, and he's getting in fights with, the frat kids. Obviously the cops know who he is because he has a history of, you know, getting in fights. And then, you know, he's behind the candy apple, a booth. A little boy tries to steal an apple. He's like, oh, you're not fast enough. And then gives it to him anyway, being like, hey, kid, you know, you're my friend. You got to be a little better as a thief. You know, I'm going to reward you for trying. And that is something you see in some of the Elvis movies is just like, we got to make sure that he's good with the little kids. Because it's almost just like you're building up like those little, those little 5 or 6 year olds, they're going to make their parents take them back to this and they're going to buy the Elvis dolls and they're going to buy everything Elvis.
And when they get older, they'll buy the Elvis albums.
Yeah. So I thought that was an interesting sort of like example of like, okay, he's got the character for like the drama, but then there's a separate Elvis character that you have to sell. So there's like multiple Elvises at work in this movie.
Well, you know, what they didn't do, at least I don't think they did, was like ever really show us the soft underbelly of Charlie Rogers. Like, there was never the scene where he sort of confides to Joan Freeman his pain at not having a family or how he's struggling. It's like, you guys, you Carney people are a family, and I never had that. And like showing us a little bit of the vulnerability before he covers it back up and says, well, to hell with all of you or something. Like, and it seems like kind of an obvious scene. I mean, as a writer, the one thing I know is obvious scenes, and I love them. But they didn't do, like, they didn't really do that, did they?
No.
They never sort of told us, they never gave the audience the moment of, oh, God, this is what is at stake here. There's a guy inside if he just allows himself to come out. And Joan Freeman sees it and before the door closes again and knows that there's a good guy in there, but no one else does, because every time anyone else sees him, he's fighting a guy or stealing a wallet or whatever it is. And she's the one who really believes in him, but he's got too much of a shell, you know, to allow the love in. They don't do any of that. And I wonder, Cullen, especially since you've seen a lot of these movies, do you have any insight into why they kind of went that route?
You know, I wish I did. I tried looking up in Peter Guralnick's Elvis bio about this movie. And Guralnick is an incredible writer. I love his stuff. He didn't have a ton to say about it. Just that it was sort of like Elvis was kind of bored. Like, the material just wasn't that lively or engaging. And in some ways it does seem, I don't know if half-assed is the right word, because I love the movie. I think it's terrific. But yeah, it doesn't go the places that you want it to or that it needs to. It's also one of three movies he did this year. The other two were Kissin' Cousins and Viva Las Vegas. And this would have been the last of them. So this might have just been rushed into production.
Interesting. And do you get a sense, again, because you're able to put these into a broader context than Chris and I, do you get the feeling that was his engagement level higher, say, in Viva Las Vegas?
It's been a few years since I've seen that, but that is my memories. Like, it's a pretty electric performance. He and Anne Margaret have great chemistry. I mean, I love George Sidney as a director. I mean, that's a movie where they put in a lot of money. There's a lot going on in that.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, not knowing, there are certain people I know a lot about. Like, I brought up the Marx Brothers. I know a little bit more about where they were, why they made the decisions they made, and sort of the trajectory of their career, not just in terms of the end result, but even their interest in doing the movies. And so I'm curious if he felt like, okay, like, did he go, Viva Las Vegas is my 1968 movie, or it was not 68, it was 64. Now, yeah, I did two other movies, but that's the one, and I'm exhausted and I wanted to take a vacation. And the fucking colonel said, no, you've got a spare month. Just go straight to the set of Roustabout and do that one, too. And he's like, oh, my God, I'm exhausted. Okay, whatever. After this, can I then finally go to Hawaii? You know, and then this one, they just squeezed out in 3 weeks. Or if there was some background story that sort of, you know, helps explain everything about it.
I wish I knew. I mean, my understanding is, I think the colonel just kept pumping him just like more, more, more.
And he would do whatever the colonel said.
Which is just kind of sad, because that guy didn't have Elvis's best interest other than Colonel's own wallet at heart.
I was about to say, he had one person's interest in mind, and it wasn't his client, that's for sure. Worst thing that ever happened to Elvis Presley was to meet Colonel Parker, but that was the best thing that ever happened to Colonel Parker, that's for sure.
The man calls himself Colonel.
And he wasn't.
That's your first clue!
I would think so, but what do I know? I mean, that's always the story, right? Is that Colonel Parker worked Elvis to death in Tahoe. I mean, you know, my mom saw Elvis, almost saw Elvis in Tahoe. I mean, he performed in Tahoe for like a long time. He was just on residency at Tahoe, making money for Colonel Parker. Like, yeah, I did this guy, Colonel Parker, ruined Elvis's life. But Elvis also, just pointing this out to everyone, Cullen, like you've mentioned, it's sad because I genuinely assume Elvis probably didn't want to deal with Colonel Parker anymore. But
now I will say, as a Californian, that and I mean I don't have a super clear memory, but I think Tahoe. When we say Tahoe, we're talking about Lake Tahoe, which is this resort community on the border of California and Nevada, way up north. Okay, I mean, easily an 8-hour car drive from Los Angeles, way north. And it has gambling on the Nevada side, and then just, you know, cabins and resort living on the California side. And, you know, Tahoe was never Vegas, but it was a place. You know, you could go and you could ski during the day and then gamble and see Elvis and Rickles, you know, all night back in the 60s and 70s. Since then, Tahoe, I think, has been in a steady decline in terms of popularity. I will tell you that Las Vegas is very popular among L.A. Hollywood types. You know, COVID notwithstanding, Vegas is still a destination. Vegas feels like a suburb of LA. It's like, we're going to Vegas this weekend. And it's like nothing. Everyone just go to Vegas and go crazy. No one says the word Tahoe. No one. It has not been spoken aloud by anyone I know for any legitimate reason in 20 years. It's not a competing destination. So the fact that Elvis was there propping it up, you know, Elvis was probably the best thing that happened to Tahoe in the late 60s and early 70s. And yeah, it's no longer on the circuit. Let's put it that way.
Is Reno lesser than all three, or is Reno in between Tahoe and Vegas?
Reno is lesser than all three. And Reno was primarily famous for a divorce destination. Yeah. Reno was where you could go from any state and receive a no-fault quick divorce. So in earlier decades, it was part of their cultural vernacular, and it's probably in movies too. It's like,
there's been a lot of books like James Cain and stuff.
Exactly. We're going to go to Reno, you know?
Oh, okay.
Definitely that's a place. Now laws change and it's no longer known for that. Reno is also a gambling destination, but again, it's just so far off the beaten path. No one has any reason to go that far out of their way to gamble.
Well, not to gamble, but to sleep. When I was on traveling with my friend's band on tour, that's where we drove, because you could get hotel rooms incredibly cheap. So we rolled in at like 3 a.m, got a room that was meant for like 2 people, and we kept trying to figure out how to sneak like 8 guys into it. And we eventually just realized we're just going to have to like duck under the front desk. And I'm sure the guy on duty knew that we were doing this, but we did it anyway because we were really tired, and we all crammed into these tiny beds. I think the room was like $25 for the night.
And this
guy just saw you guys, was like, they don't pay me enough to deal with this.
This was like 2013, 2014.
Oh my God. That's like the recent past.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So Reno, what was your impression of Reno?
When we were driving in, the welcome to Reno sign, the R and the E was, the lights were out, so it just said welcome to No. It just kind of seemed perfect. I mean, like the rugs just reeked of cigarettes from decades past. Oh. Everything looked like it should have been in an 80s movie. Like, it looked really run down. You know, we went into some of the pawn shops because I think one of the guys was looking for a wedding ring, and like, there were just like lots of like 1992, 1994 CDs that had been pawned. It was just kind of bleak all around.
Wow. It's crazy because I will tell you that my parents, okay, I'm in LA. My parents were in LA, were, you know, LA people. They met in Los Angeles, and they would go to Reno every once in a while. We would go on family, picture this, we would go on family trips to Las Vegas. So in one Country Squire station wagon, it would be my mother, my father, my grandmother, my grandfather, and my brother and I. So 6 people in this station wagon hauling to Las Vegas, where my brother and I were like 8 and 10. Like, there was nothing for us to do except go to Circus, you know, and, you know, play some rigged, you know, basically roustabout carnival games and try to win a stuffed pink panther. And, but my parents, when they wanted a romantic weekend on their own, would go to Reno.
Big spending.
Reno always had this weird illicit, like even to an 8-year-old, it felt, you know, sort of sordid and darkly sexual. It's like, ooh, this is where grown-ups go to do grown-up things. Go.
They also, Reno had a hardcore scene in the early 80s. That's where 7 Seconds was from.
Oh, really? I didn't know that at all. I didn't know there was a, it had that moment.
Yeah, apparently there were a ton of bands that came out of there. I'd like to know more about, the only one I really know is 7 Seconds. I'd like to look up some of the other ones.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, briefly getting back to Elvis, you know, one of the reasons I'm so enchanted with anything that has to do with carnivals or the Midway or any of that is those early trips to Las Vegas when we would go to Circus Circus. And I, you know, and, you know, my parents, this was in the 70s. So my parents would be like, well, we're going to go gamble for the next 7 hours. So here's $5. I guess go to the mezzanine and enjoy yourself at Circus Circus. And then my brother and I would just wander up there. And, you know, there were a bunch of like kids wandering around unaccompanied and unmentored. And you would just play these carnival games. And we got pretty good at some of them and would win stuff. But it was really fun. It was like spending all day at a carnival, except indoors.
I want to do this now.
You would love it.
This sounds fun.
You would friggin' love it. What I didn't realize until I was an adult was that one of the best steakhouses in all of Las Vegas was at Circus Circus. And I went there not believing it. But let me tell you, if you've never had zebra...
Wait.
The meat?
Wait, I'm confused.
Oh, Richard, you bastard.
I was going to say, I don't think you can eat zebra.
Oh, you can if it's cooked correctly.
Yeah, I was about to say, in Vegas, anything is possible for the right price.
Aww. I like zebras.
Funny enough, we're talking about carnival workers. Do you know what Colonel Parker's background was before he moved into music promotion?
No.
Cannibals.
Would it surprise you to learn he was a carnival worker?
No. Well, that's funny because on this movie, his title is Technical Advisor.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think they put a decent amount of attention on getting the atmosphere of the carnival. Like,
yeah,
they seem to pay a lot more attention to that than they do the actual story.
Oh, hey, if I may call out two characters, two actors, the smallest of them all, Billy Barty.
Oh, man.
Playing the resident midget. And of course, the tallest man ever, played by, in the movie, Richard Kiel.
Yep.
Richard Kiel of Night Stalker fame.
I didn't realize that was him.
You can't tell that it's him until the very last shot of the movie, that big wide shot when Elvis jumps off the stage and starts singing and moving through the carnival and sort of checking in and tapping in with all the different people. And he gets up on that thing and he passes the bearded lady. And he passes the tall man who's wearing the Fred Flintstone caveman, you know, sort of tunic. And as that guy turns around, unmistakably Richard
Kiel. This is the last shot of the movie, right?
Yeah, last shot of the movie.
That's an incredible, not to skip to the end, but that's a really incredible shot that sort of like reverses like crane shot with like hundreds of extras all at the same time. Yeah. Like that's a really well choreographed scene, I thought.
So when this final shot was done, I was watching the movie in my office on my computer. My wife, Susan, comes in and for a moment was just like, you know, what's this? What are you guys watching tonight? And kind of just catching up on the last 90 seconds of the movie and watching it. And at the very end, he goes into a clinch with Joan Freeman, but he doesn't kiss her. Did you notice this?
Yeah.
He does not kiss her. It's a hug.
Yeah.
It is very chaste. And she's like, he didn't kiss her. Why didn't he kiss her? That's weird. He should be, it's the final shot of the movie. They're the romantic leads. Shouldn't he have kissed her? What do you make of that?
I thought that was strange too. Cause like this, here's Elvis, right? Like here's Elvis.
Yeah.
Like
he's now committing her. He says he loves her. He says it. It's okay now. They can do this now. It's allowed.
I wonder if it had to do with trying to appeal to a certain age of boy that, like, because throughout the whole movie, even when he's with Sue Ann Langdon, the fortune teller, it's just like you don't really see them locking lips. It's just like you never really see much.
There's not a lot of macking.
And like to me, my guess would be like, how do we sell this movie to 11-year-old boys? Well, we can't have too much because they still think girls are gross. But it's like, we still need Elvis to be handsome because there's like another age of guys that are going to want to be like, oh yeah, he's a ladies' man. And it's like, we still got to sell him to women as well. And it's like, there's so many different Elvises trying to be sold at the same time.
So for the girls and the older guys and then the 11-year-old boys, these Venn diagrams all begin to converge. And the only overlay is motorcycles,
singing,
maybe
leather.
Carnival.
Leather is just for Richard, though.
The leather is for girls and homosexual men in the 60s who
are into Richard
and sword swallowing. And that's where all the Venn diagrams meet. There you go.
I mean, one of the things I really love about the late Elvis movies are just they're so focused on just kind these things you're talking about. It's like motorcycles, water skis, cars, boats, scuba diving, songs, clothes, dances, clubs, restaurants. It's just like it's a lot of like weird fetishy objects, but it's just like, I don't know. To me, it's just like, this is not my world at all.
No.
But I watch this world and I'm like, man, it would be fun to be Elvis in this world in some weird way. It's just like you get on stage, you sing, get thrown in jail. Someone bails you out. You get on your bike, you go to the next place. Like nothing really matters.
Wash, rinse, repeat. I mean, you assume in this movie up until this point he's been going around doing this everywhere, right? Like,
yeah,
showing up, kind of, you know, being aroused about and then leaving. I, you know, to your point, Colin, there's this like weird fetishization of it. It's just very, it seems to me, you know, Elvis is very much a reflection on America and Americans. I mean, even the way Elvis died, right? Like, oh, you know, old fat Elvis or whatever on the toilet. I mean,
nothing more American than ODing on the toilet.
I mean, unfortunately,
saying, Chris? God, you liberals, I tell
you. Yeah, right. Unfortunately, Elvis does kind of serve as a cautionary tale for the worst of what happens when celebrity becomes your life. I mean, like, Elvis was similar to Michael Jackson, right? Like, he couldn't go anywhere without people knowing who he was. Like, if Elvis had been around the same time as Michael Jackson, he too would have rented out Disneyland just for him and his kids and gone around on a golf cart. Like, Michael Jackson did that. Elvis did that. It's weird because, again, like, who Elvis is in my mind is monolithic, right? Like, it's like the Beatles, Elvis, and then, like, a handful of other people. But they are so far up at the top of, like, the pop culture mountain that they've kind of broken through the stratosphere of like everything else. And they're at the top where like people everywhere know who Elvis is. And he's just this little kid from, you know, Tupelo who made good. And so when you watch a movie like this, like you said, Cullen, it's weird because like they try to just put in as many things as people will like and associate Elvis with them and see what happens. Like,
well, was it just a matter of like, we're going to basically do the same movie just in different aesthetic environments. Like this one's at the carnival. This one's in a jail. This one's in Hawaii. This one's in Vegas. But we're more or less going to take him through. He's going to meet a girl. He's going to, you know, come up against some phonies. And people are going to discover during the course of the movie that he's Elvis.
I mean, there's definitely similar elements. Like clam bake is a... I looked at the Wikipedia article and apparently some people claim it's the worst movie ever made. I actually would put it up as one of my favorite Elvis movies. He is he's like the son of somebody that's like super rich and he's tired of being this person. And so he switches identities with a water ski instructor. And so they like show up at the resort and like everybody thinks the water ski instructor's the son of this rich guy. And Elvis pretends to be someone who's more like lower class working, trying to make good.
Classic. That's a class. I mean, come on. Prince and the Pauper. Come on.
Yeah. That's a, it's a fun movie, but also that one has like, like Aunt Elsa Lanchester, you know, the bride of Frankenstein, she's in it. She has like a yoga studio, which is amazing. And then there's another number where it's just like him with a bunch of kids, like on like a jungle gym where I think he's like trying to, you know, give them like advice and get them to get their spirits up. And it's just like, you have to have the number to sell Elvis to the little kids.
Yeah.
And nothing else. There's no kids in the rest of the movie. Well, it's just like, you need something for those toddlers.
I mean, that you keep bringing that up, and that's really interesting. Like, I would love to know what they must have gotten numbers back and discovered that, oh, kids go see these movies. That's a significant portion of our audience. We need to lean into that.
I would like to rewatch all the Elvis movies again in order. To see the evolution of his character. When I saw them, they were all like haphazard, like whatever I could get my hands on. I did watch them all within like 3 or 4 months. But I'd like to see like how, like, I can't remember what point I, you know, the kids just sort of jumped out of me. So I don't know how many movies that's in, but it's clearly in these two. And I think I like the Elvis movies. I think they're interesting.
What they remind me of is like the Mary-Kate and Ashley movies. You know what I mean? Like, what you're talking about, Richard, is like you're making movies for the people. You're not making movies for other people. This movie is made for Elvis to be in it.
Yeah.
And for
the fans who go to see him in the theater. And I guess I would have just assumed it was all like young, you know, teenage girls, like the, you know, the. But I'm sure it was some guys, too, who thought Elvis was cool and wanted to sort of like see his moves. And then the kids, I guess I didn't count on. I didn't realize that he had such a following of sort of high school and below.
I mean, he was the biggest thing, right? He was the biggest thing at the time until somebody like the Beatles came along. Like, Elvis was the shit. Elvis was the thing. Like, if you don't like Elvis, like, you at the time, people probably looked at you sideways. Like, how do you not like Elvis? Because, I mean, we're past the point now of the Ed Sullivan Show where it's like, don't show him from the waist down. Like, we're past that now. Elvis is mainstream. Like, Elvis is real mainstream. This is not even Elvis's first movie. This is like his, what, Cullen? Like, 10th at least?
10th after the war. It's like his 15th movie.
Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. His 16th movie. In 8 years.
That's crazy.
Thanks, Colonel Parker.
That's Abbott and Costello level, you know.
And that's what this strikes me as, right? Like, it's just very, like, it's a movie that's made to make a movie because you have Elvis in it. But that the thing is, it ends up being more entertaining than I think a lot of the people who made the movie. Clearly Elvis, if he was, you know, uninterested, I think we can all agree that doesn't bode well for the movie, but it's more entertaining than I think even Elvis probably would give it credit for.
Put it this way, their supporting cast is off the charts.
Yeah.
I mean, Pat Buttram, Barbara Stanwyck, but then, I mean, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. Leif Erikson, Joan Freeman, they're all great.
Jack Albertson.
I mean, like, even Jack Albertson's only in the movie for 5 minutes, but just go down the line, even just the character roles of the guy who's throwing the baseballs at the dunk tank.
He's so sadistic. It's like disturbing. He does a good job.
He's great. He's
who
like,
who wants to see,
like,
me toss this little lady in the water? Anybody got $10? You're a dick, dude. I'll give her a bath.
She'll never forget.
I'm going to make her wet. I mean, it was disturbing. He was like Dan Hedaya before Dan Hedaya existed. He just had that dark, sweaty, you
know. I just
need
to open his shirt. Aspect. I need to see if he has the hair like Dan Hedaya. Dan Hedaya,
but I mean,
hairiest man in the industry.
Who, I don't know who cast the movie, but they cast every role was spot on. You know, the guy, Cody, the guy running the Ferris wheel, who's like, you just got to learn to keep your mouth shut. I'm like, I love that guy. I hope he's in every scene. Well, he was on and off. But yeah, so a lot to recommend it. But I guess my question, Cullen, is for a guy like me and a guy like Chris who haven't seen a lot, and if we were restricted to only two more Elvis movies for the balance of our lives, what would those two movies be?
Oh man, that's tough. I do just think Viva Las Vegas is just like a fabulous movie. Beyond that,
all right,
man, I would say
one more.
You know, I would be tempted to say, I mean, King Creole, maybe.
King Creole, not Jailhouse Rock, not Love Me Tender.
It's tough. It's because you got to say one. It's tough because, like, I do think you do need, like, Love Me Tender, Loving You, Jailhouse Rock, King Creole. Like, those four are just, like, some of the best that he's done. And so I think you kind of need to look at different periods. So it's like, that's the early period. Like,
okay, King Creole early, Viva Las Vegas a little later. But why King Creole? What is, like, the thing about that that pushes it ahead of Jailhouse?
I mean, they're all good. I mean, it's almost just like throwing a dart. Like, honestly, okay, just like when Chris brought that movie up, I was just like, oh man, like, I'd like to see that again.
All right. Now
those four are like from what I remember, like, well done, just like a little more serious movies. Then you get sort of, they get sillier as they go on. I think this is a pretty good example of like mid to late Elvis when it's getting a little goofy. I'm trying to look at the late ones to see if there's another one.
Girl Happy has a song in it, Richard, called Do the Clam. It's pretty great.
Love that. That was my first dance at both my weddings.
Do the Clam.
Yeah. Those late ones, you know, definitely poke around. I think you kind of have to see more than three Elvis movies. I think maybe five to six is the number. You don't have to watch them all like in a month, but I feel like, you know, it's like, okay, you're a film fan, you like American cinema of like the 50s and 60s. I think carving out time for five or six Elvis movies is, I don't know, I think it's worthwhile. I think it's doable. I don't think it's asking too much.
And Elvis is unavoidable at the time. So, I mean, you know, he's a big part of pop culture. So he would be hard to avoid if you were going to the cinemas in the late 50s and 60s anyways. So, yeah, he's a big part of American cinema. So
here's a question for you. Because, Chris, you mentioned the Beatles. The Beatles also had movies as products to help sell them. When is Hard Day's Night? That is the same year, 1964.
Yeah.
These are two wildly different movies.
Diametrically opposed.
Just even the way they appear on screen and like the idea of what is the image of the musician as actor. I'm going to collect my thoughts, but I'm hoping that one of you two has something more insightful to say on this topic while I formulate something.
We're going to be talking a lot about Elvis this month, so I don't want to let too much out of the bag. But there is this weird cognitive dissonance that I've never understood with Elvis, where Elvis was this guy who apparently liked the Beatles, but then when he spoke with Nixon was like, you know, fuck these anti-communist, you know, Britpop guys. Which makes no sense, because then Elvis would go on to be like, well, they also do drugs. So it's like, Elvis, this is exactly what you did. It's very weird. The Beatles, I felt like, were at least always true to themselves. And in that, Cullen, like you said, in the way they're presented in Hard Day's Night, they're kind of just presented the way the Beatles, I think, were in many ways. Elvis in these movies, he's playing Elvis, but not... He's like what we assume Elvis was, not who Elvis really was.
Well, I think your comparison to Michael Jackson is interesting, because it's like he's a sort of a creation, almost like a corporate creation and a product that represents an image of himself. Whereas the Beatles were a little bit, like you said, more open as they transitioned from one sphere of musical or you know, cultural influence to the next, they were a little bit more open. Like now we're more into, you know, drugs. Now we're more into Eastern philosophy and religion. And they let the audience in on there was no Colonel Parker telling them, God damn it, put those little outfits back on and you're the mop tops and that's all you're ever going to be. And right. America doesn't want to see you playing the goddamn sitar.
Yeah.
It's funny. I'm thinking of Elvis as an actor, and he almost reminds me more of like Abbott and Costello, in that when you see an Abbott and Costello movie, it's always Abbott and Costello, even though the script gives them a character.
Yeah.
And so I feel like, well, obviously this is Elvis we're watching, but they're trying to give him a character. But no matter what character he plays, it's always just like window dressing because we're just looking at Elvis. And I think the Beatles in Hard Day's Night and Help, they never had that like alternate character that they were trying to go for. Like the illusion of a narrative didn't exist the way it does in this movie.
Yeah, they were true to themselves. I mean, and like Richard said, I mean, Colonel Parker drove a lot of the things that Elvis did. He made a lot of decisions for Elvis. Elvis never toured overseas, which is a legitimately insane, fucking crazy ass thing. If you hear that out loud, it sounds insane. Do you know why Elvis didn't tour overseas? Because Colonel Parker was essentially like either an illegal immigrant here illegally or a criminal. And if he went overseas, he would have to show who he was, and who he was not who he said he was, because he was from the Netherlands. Colonel Tom Parker is not even his birth name. He immigrated to the United States from the Netherlands and just kind of, you know, fell into taking 50% of Elvis's money.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And people didn't know that until I think he died. So what's even crazier is you have like a carny in charge of Elvis, the guy, one of the guys. And what's crazy is it's, you know, you have sometimes these really important people in pop culture who get these other people attached to him that just fucking, like, look at Britney Spears. It's the same thing.
Oh, that's fucking sad.
It is the same thing, though. You know, it's like being worked to the bone by your manager. It's worse with Britney Spears because it's her fucking dad.
Oh, that's so common with these young women actresses and pop stars. Can you imagine the record companies who were like, we're leaving millions and millions and millions of dollars on the table, not sending him around the world to promote these albums? And they do sell, but they could sell even more. And we would get a share of the door as he goes throughout Europe and Asia and South America and wherever. And they're like, oh, but Colonel Tom Parker says no, so Elvis says no, so we're fucked. That's an amazing story right then and there.
Who do you think was driven up the wall? Everybody but Colonel Tom Parker, who sat in that room and smirked to himself like an idiot.
Yep.
So, Cullen, I'm curious, skip or watch?
Oh, watch. I think it gives you a good taste of, again, sort of like mid to late period Elvis movies. Not my favorite, but I think it. I love it. I think it was a really a very wonderful selection of Father Malone to pick this one. It was a nice surprise. I was happy to rewatch it.
What about you, Richard?
I say skip. If you're going to watch an Elvis movie, sounds like Love Me Tender or Jailhouse Rock or Viva Las Vegas or King Creole might give you a better sense of his highlights. This almost feels like someone asking, hey, if I'm going to watch a Marx Brothers movie, should I see At the Circus? And I would kind of go, no, you should see Duck Soup or Horse Feathers with Night at the Opera coming in, you know, a distant fifth or something. So I'm going to say skip it and watch the other ones that Cullen recommended.
I think I'm with Cullen. I'm going to say watch it. I'm excited to see Fun in Acapulco. I may on my own go and see these other movies that you mentioned, Cullen. But to your point, Cullen, like and Richard, to many, respects, like, I don't think, I mean, Cullen, you've said as much, like, this is not in the top four. It may not even be in the top 10, but it's still an Elvis movie, so it has its charm, and Elvis is charming, so that goes a long way, clearly.
I'm tickled. I again applaud Father Malone. I think this was a nice, unexpected choice, and yeah.
Well, on that note, let's get on to a preview for Father Malone's next choice of You've Never Seen September.
You know he's gone, 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 jumping like a catfish on a pole. Yeah. You know he's gone, 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 and I'm shaking King Creole. You know it's gone, gone, gone. You're shaking King Creole.
You're a pretty fancy performer, ain't you, kid?
How you know what I do for an encore?
Now he crowns his meteoric rise to fame with a fiery burst of dramatic power as hard-loving, hard-hitting Danny Fisher, who sang his way up from the gutters of lusty, brawling New Orleans.
I would never treat you badly, like a castaway broken toy. Love a doll, I love you madly, let me be your lover boy.
I've stacked chairs and bottles and swept the floor up of every joint on Bourbon Street. It's gotten so I look longer at a dame with clothes on and one without. I'm not a hoodlum, but I am a hustler. I've had to be for a very simple reason.
Young dream,
young dream, young dream.
My heart is filled with young dream,
dream.
And I'm longing to share them all with you.
There were to be many women in Danny's young life, but only two who really counted. Nellie, who knew too little about love.
I've never been to a place like this before. But I want to see you again. Is this the way?
Ronnie, who knew too much.
Ronnie, what are you doing here with this man? How'd you get into this?
How do you get out?
Fighting for the upper hand, the devil-driven temper that was his pathway to destruction.
Get out of here, Ronnie! We'll come back!
Louisiana, baby, tells you, stay a while.
Yeah!
Live it up.
Yeah!
Love it up.
Yeah!
Some style.
We're down in New
Orleans. New Orleans!
On the next episode of the Culture Cast, we're going to talk about King Creole, a movie that Cullen has mentioned, not Fun at Acapulco, which he never mentioned once, I don't think. But King Creole, which, Cullen, like you said, pretty good, right?
Yeah, it's a solid movie.
I'm looking forward to it. Until then, Richard, where can people find you if you're not here?
Well, they can find me on HBO Max. We're currently enjoying a fabulous run of season 3 of Titans. Fans are going out of their freaking minds. And The consensus seems to be it's the best season ever, which I can't argue. So I would say go over to HBO Max, check out season 1 and 2, and then roll right into the climactic season 3.
What about you, Cullen? Where can people find you?
I'm still at pulpserenade.com, pulp-serenade.com. The dash is important because I lost the URL without the dash. And I've been unable to successfully buy it back. If anyone listening knows how to buy URLs from weird companies that just use it to promote products that don't exist or some shit, like someone bought my URL and doesn't really use it. If anybody knows how I can buy it back, please let me know.
It's a conversation Cullen and I will be having after the podcast, clearly, because I have an answer to that question.
Oh, shit.
I can help best I can. As for me, you can find me at cstachiw.com. That's my link tree. That's where you can go to hear all the stuff I work on, like a show that I work on with Richard called Rankin on Bass, where we talk about Rankin and Bass productions, not just Christmas ones. No, Richard, not just Christmas ones, huh?
God, no. Every last goddamn thing they ever dragged their dick across, we're talking about.
Anything that they breathed on. Rankin and Bass breathed on this. Arthur Rankin looked at this on his desk at one point. But that's where you can find me. Culturecast.com is where you can find the show. Thank you to Richard and Cullen for joining me. We'll catch you on the next episode.